It's July 13th today?
Yeah.
Yes, it's July 13th. We're talking to Christopher Jenkins in Berkeley, California. And good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, good afternoon, almost. one of the things we always ask is a standard question, just pronounce your name and your birthday.
Christopher Jenkins, July 21st, 1943.
Okay, great. Where were you born in 1943?
In Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia.
Uh-huh. And did you go to high school in Bryn Mawr?
No, I went to boarding school in Connecticut.
In Connecticut. What was the name of that school?
Taft School.
And what did your parents do when you were growing up?
My mother was always a housewife. My dad worked for the Alice Chalmers Manufacturing Company mm-hmm. as a businessman. That's what I always thought he was.
Uh-huh. And when you went to Taft, I mean is it an Episcopal school?
No, it's not a religious school.
What religious background did you have prior to that?
Well, I was raised as an Episcopalian. I was good. Uh-huh. But my father was a self-proclaimed agnostic, mm-hmm. and that was kind of a source of tension in our family, because mm-hmm. my mother was a very active church woman and hung out at the church a lot and mm-hmm. hung out with the minister, and my dad never would go near the place.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to Taft, actually, Don Cohen was at Taft. And
right.
He had agnostic parents, interestingly enough.
Uh-huh.
And,
but the difference for Don was that he is Jewish.
Yes.
Which he told me later on, you know, in our adult life, which I never thought of him as a Jew mm-hmm. before, but he did during those years.
Yeah. And, it is an issue because there were several Jews in IPS, and certainly it was more diverse than some people think. Mm-hmm. One went immediately from Laos because it was just getting too dangerous and arrived in Israel to fight in the Six-Day War. And, of course, the same thing happened to Don, where when he left Vietnam, he went via Israel and ended up filling sandbags.
Oh, really?
During the Six-Day War.
Oh.
So there were actually two IBSers in Israel during the Six-Day mm-hmm. War, which is in itself an interesting mm-hmm. Thing. When did you first hear about IBS?
Well, I went to Stanford, mm-hmm. and my senior year there was I applied to go in the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. and I was going to go to Tanzania, actually. But there was a summer program through a group called Volunteers in Asia mm-hmm. to go to Vietnam for the summer, and I applied to go on that program. And but the Volunteers in Asia program in Vietnam was through IBS, sort of a subcontract or whatever with IBS. So after being, though, in Vietnam for 3 months, I decided I didn't want to come home and go to Tanzania with the Peace Corps. And so one night I was in Saigon at IBS headquarters. I actually slept in Don Luce's room on the upper bunk. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, why don't you stay on with IBS? And I said, yeah, okay. But I said, the one thing I was really looking forward to, this was at the end of my summer in 1966, was the chance to go take my return home, my free trip home.
Mm-hmm. From Volunteers in Asia.
From Volunteers in Asia back to the U.S. because I was going to visit my sister mm-hmm. and her husband in Greece. At that time, they lived on an island in the Aegean Sea.
Which one?
It was called Spetsi.
Okay.
So I was really looking forward to that. And so he said, well, fine. Why don't you just take your trip, you know, go visit your sister, have a good time, and then come back. So that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So I got my cake and I ate it too.
but as a result of that, when you were accepted into IBS, did you go to Harper's Ferry for...
No, I never did.
They just felt that you'd already been in country, so
Right. I never had any kind of orientation in the States.
So you just got a plane ticket from IBS and flew to Saigon?
Well, it was my Volunteers in Asia plane ticket, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd gone out with Volunteers in Asia.
And that included a return.
And you'd come back.
Yeah, but I... Well, I went from San Francisco to Saigon.
Uh-huh.
Worked for 3 months.
Right.
Then I went from Saigon to Athens.
Uh-huh.
And I came back to Saigon.
Okay.
That was all Volunteers in Asia. Yes. And then IBS began.
Right. Uh-huh. Great. Now, what made you... can you think of some reason why you wanted to join Volunteers in Asia in the first place?
Yeah. You know, especially my senior year, that would have been 1965, 66.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 1964, I was in France with a Stanford in France program.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a neat experience. There were 80 students, 40 men, 40 women. And one day, someone bought the New York Times and they came in and said, "Hey, look, you know, the Vietnamese, or we shelled the Gulf of Tonkin, and this place is called Vietnam." And I could remember Vietnam from my stamp collection, you know, when I was a kid. But that was my first memory of the word or the concept of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was this Gulf of Tonkin incident, as reported. Maybe it was the Herald Tribune, probably was the
mm-hmm.
International Herald Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And this friend of mine was Tom Fox, who's another IDSer,
mm-hmm.
who's now editor of the National Catholic Reporter in
mm-hmm.
Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's anyone you're going to interview.
I think his name's on the list, but I'll make a note of it. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So Tom was, you know, a fellow student at Stanford, and he was in France in my group. And he was a Catholic. Of course, he still is, but a progressive Catholic. And he was very concerned about war, and so he kind of got me interested. So then when I returned to Stanford, the war had become a big issue. And as someone who was a potential draftee, like yourself, you know, I was really plunged into the thick of it, into trying to decide where I stood. And I think I knew pretty clearly where I stood, 'cause I just naturally don't like violence and war, I think. But that year at Stanford, there were demonstrations. We marched to plants in Redwood City that produced napalm.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty
this was in
good target. In about 1965,
1965,
it would have been. And then there were lots of noon rallies in the quad or the plaza. Lots of teach-ins, and so all those questions were being asked. And so when the opportunity arose to actually me go to Vietnam, I thought, hey, this is exciting, and this really turns me on. I will have an opportunity to really see my own what's happening and to make my own decisions about what's happening, you know, and I'll be able to weigh all these different things that are being said in these demonstrations, these rallies, and I'll know myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it was a free trip to Vietnam. I thought it sounded great.
For 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was your first impression? I mean, you went out there to learn something, and Volunteers in Asia. What did you do?
Well, there were a group of 8 of us, and we went on Pan American flight number 1, 707, I guess, you know, which stopped in Honolulu for an hour. Or maybe it was longer than an hour, actually, because I know we all got in a cab or two, and we went out to the Punch Bowl or something, and which is about as much as you could see in a short layover in Honolulu. And then we went to Hong Kong. And I had an old girlfriend in Hong Kong, who at that time had married a Hong Kong Chinese man. That's a long story.
Yes, right.
And then we went to Saigon. And I was sent to Thuy Hoa, which is a small city on the coast, central coast. And I was placed with the family of a judge, the provincial judge of the province. Tuy Hoa is the capital of the province of Phú Yên at that time. So this was downtown. And he lived kind of above the courthouse itself. And behind the courthouse, there was a courtyard and a compound. And I lived in a room that was in that compound around the courtyard. But I ate with the judge and his family. And the judge had a son who was a little bit younger than me. And they viewed it as kind of a privilege to have an American living in the household who could speak English and teach their son English, you know, and maybe provide some of the advantages that being associated with Americans might provide. But so the judge was a privileged man. He had a jeep at his disposal. He was relatively wealthy. After dinner, we would go for drives. The family would get in the car, he and his wife and his son and me, and drive around town, which was fun, you know, to get to see things. I remember actually once driving around town, outside of town actually, through the rice paddies and small village off to one side, and there was a person who had died. And what they told me is that person died because of a bad wind. You know, well, how do you say it in Vietnamese? I forget now, but anyway, that was the concept, that they were killed by the wind. And later, I think I was to decide that it wasn't really, it was what we would call a heart attack or a stroke, but to them it was a bad wind. Well, let's see, living with that judge, there was an evening, so you asked about my impressions. There was an evening we had kind of a fancy dinner in the courtyard behind his home, and we were served by young women in aozais. And those women then were asked to perform, like to sing. So it was kind of, in retrospect, it was kind of an uncomfortable situation. Oh, I was asked to sing too, actually. But there was this kind of objectification of the women and me as objects who were there for his pleasure, for his entertainment. And the women were subservient. You know, they served him and us, and then they were asked to perform and to look beautiful in their aozais. And for me, I was strange. I was a foreigner. I was one of those Americans. And I was asked to sing. And I think I sang, "There is a house in New Orleans, the house of the rising sun." But that was because that was a popular song at that time. I mean, that was Joan Baez, you know. So that was my music. And that was, I knew the words to that song. So that made me kind of uncomfortable. There was another experience where he was the provincial judge. He was good friends with the province chief and the province police chief. So that was like a little triumvirate. And there was one evening where I was invited to join them at a dinner. Again, it's an outdoor dinner, which was set up outside a village to the south of Tuy Hoa, kind of on the beach. There was a lot of sand. I mean, it was a big, wide beach. But very nearby, there was a refugee camp surrounded by barbed wire. And so if you can imagine a long table with maybe 50 people eating, and there was a roast pig on the table, and Johnny Walker, and again, these women serving us. And it was very festive, you know. But right behind us was this refugee camp, with all these hungry, poor people clinging to the wire and not struggling to get out or anything, but just with these kind of empty, gaunt looks staring at us as we ate all this food and all the Vietnamese men getting drunk and pawing the women. And it was So the contrast between the people in power, the military, the police, the legal system, at this banquet table with the refugees in the cage behind us was really disturbing for me. There was another time, my function that summer was to put together a youth program to dig latrines, which is what we did. But this that activity took me into villages, and I remember being at an orphanage in a village, maybe where we were digging latrines, and there was a American military truck that pulled into the orphanage, ostensibly I think to do something good, but the truck was too big really to get through the gate, which was surrounded by two brick columns that were covered with stucco, and they simply knocked them over as they drove in. And again, that was just sort of, to me, symbolic of the clumsy effort of Americans to help, you know, where their truck was just too damn big to get through the gate, and they didn't know it, and they just, and they didn't really do very much. I mean, they were, it was awkward, this, oh gosh, you know, Sin Loi, sorry about that, you know, but they didn't really do anything about it. And, you know, the nuns at the orphanage smiled and took whatever it was, you know, the garbage for their pigs or something, and said thank you, but it just seemed so disingenuous to me. There was actually another time, which was much more serious, when I was with students. We were digging, I think it was a three-hole latrine for a community. I can't remember if it was a village or a school, but it was kind of near Route 1, which was the main highway. And there were little kids around, and there was, again, an American military truck that drove by fast on the highway, and it ran over a kid. And I can't remember exactly what happened, whether the kid was actually killed or seriously wounded, and I wasn't really directly, I know a lot of activity happened, and I guess I never really learned what the outcome of that was, but that was very upsetting to me too, to see the consequences of the American military presence in relation to the Vietnamese civilian population that was there. It was just, you know, they were killing little kids in spite of themselves, basically. So that was my first 3 months. It was also very beautiful. I mean, it was a small city, but it was surrounded by rice fields. And I have 8mm, you know, movies of the rice fields, you know, little 3-minute movies from the movie camera I bought in Hong Kong on the way from my ex-girlfriend's husband. That was part of the story. But
you have a tape recorder too?
I didn't have a tape recorder.
Because a lot of volunteers
bought
these little tiny reel-to-reel miniature.
No,
but you do want to transfer that 8mm film to video.
I do.
You have to. The nitrates might deteriorate.
Right. I really. That's
like
one of my projects.
Or something.
Yeah. Right. I must do that. But the images I have on the film are of the rice blowing in the wind. It's like waves. It's just gorgeous. You know, it's really beautiful. And, well, I got to go into the villages a lot, and I got to really, actually, one time I remember I went with a guy named Jerry Tinker, who was an aide to Kennedy, to which Kennedy would it have been? To Ted Kennedy, I guess, who was head of the Senate Refugee Committee. And he was in there, you know, preparing reports about what was happening to refugees. That was interesting to me, to know that the long arm of the Congress Research Service was actually extending into this very remote place where I felt I was. I also actually saw for the first time dead people. I mean, I mentioned that person who was killed by the wind, but I also saw two dead VC. You know, one day I came to a village and these two men were brothers who were from that village, and they had gone to join the National Liberation Front. They had come back that night to, I don't know, to do what in the village, but they were killed and their bodies were laid out in the village for everyone to see. And by the time I got there, they were kind of gray. But I just never seen close up dead bodies. And I know that's on my 8mm film as well. But that was very upsetting to see dead bodies and to know their story, that they were from that village.
Were you when you were with Volunteers in Asia, were you studying Vietnamese?
Not formally.
Not formally.
Actually. But I had learned a little bit before I came, because I had a friend at Stanford whose name was David Jung, who was the son of a Jung Ding Zhu, who had been, or was about to be, I can't remember, the so-called peace candidate in the South Vietnamese elections, who ran against, you know, Ki or somebody like that, and lost. But he told me how to say Nuk Mam. So I came equipped with that.
You came equipped with that. You could ask for it, and not right. Knowing yet what it was.
Well, he told me what it was and what it smelled like.
What it smelled like.
The role it played.
Made.
Yeah.
Yes, it's more of how it's made. That's
yeah.
Fascinating. What led you to the bunk in Don Luce's room, where the IVS issue came up?
Well.
Did Volunteers in Asia stay there at the IVS
house? I guess we must have, yeah. So we were as if we were IVS volunteers. And, you know, Don was a very friendly guy, and he had a room with a spare bed, so he always had, you know, people come in. And it was always a friendly, you know, place to go. Leben Zuyep Noizai was the street. I can't remember the number. And it's, I think, just about unrecognizable now. I mean, I've been back, but I couldn't take you to it.
No, I tried when I was there. I wasn't involved in looking for it. I knew where it was, roughly. Mm. But that whole area is just completely different. It's mm-hmm. still built up.
Yeah.
It was.
Because it had a big backyard and a big compound behind it, which probably was all been built up.
So as your 3 months at Volunteers in Asia came to an end,
mm-hmm.
you were happy with Don. Don said, why don't you join IBS? And you said, hey, yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's something to do.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to stay in, well, the choice really was going back to the States and joining the Peace Corps,
mm-hmm.
or staying in Vietnam. Why did you just not say, well, gee, I've done my 3 months
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam, this has been interesting, I don't want to be in the Peace Corps. That is, we know why you wanted to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to learn about it. It was something mm-hmm. in the news. It was something on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Why the Peace Corps? Why was that an option you were thinking of?
Well, there was another thing that was, I know, figuring. This doesn't really answer your question
mm-hmm.
directly, but so don't let me forget it.
None of my questions are direct ones anyway. So it doesn't matter.
I know that I was very homesick, or I was very lonely.
Mm-hmm.
I was very at loose ends when I was in Tuy Hoa. That was part of the experience too, was, you know, my God, what am I doing here? And I really feel uncomfortable and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't really like it too much here. And then I thought ahead to the future. I said, gosh, what I have in store is going home and then going through all this all over again in a still more godforsaken place,
mm-hmm.
Tanzania. And, well, Tanzania may be attractive, but the thought of having to go to yet a different part of the world, learn another language, make friends in a new place, get to know people, was not at all attractive. And I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of getting to know what it's like here in Vietnam. And I'm starting to learn some of the language. And there are some, you know, there are some things I do like about it. So given that choice, I would much rather stay in Vietnam than to go through all this stuff all over again. The option of just going home, I didn't know what I would do if I just went home, because I didn't really have any plans. There was no graduate school, there were no group of friends who were into something that I wanted to be a part of. I had no idea what I was going to be when I grew up in terms of a job.
Is that why you applied for the Peace Corps in the first place?
Part of it, yeah. Because I didn't want to know what I wanted to do when I grew up.
Yeah. Well, no, that you graduated, you got your BA in June of 66.
Yeah.
And you were with volunteers in Asia in the summer of 66.
Right.
So you were in the summer of 66, and but then you had, while you were in Vietnam, you learned you'd been accepted to the Peace Corps?
I think before I went.
Before you went to Vietnam, you
but that wasn't to start till the fall.
Exactly. But you had applied for the Peace Corps.
Right.
Before the volunteers in Asia thing had come up.
Right.
And so I'm actually just trying to probe why originally you thought of doing overseas volunteer service in the first place.
Oh, right.
There was not, we know why you went to volunteers in Asia. That was not just that,
right,
but also something else.
Well, sure. Because it was that, that sort of crisis of graduation, you know, what do you do now?
Uh-huh.
You know, your whole life has been programmed up to that point. You know, it's been school, basically. So what does one do? Is there life after graduation? So.
Well, a lot of people just say, I'll go to law school. You know, they don't
right.
say, they say, or some people say, I always remember John F. Kennedy's speech and I thought I would do
it. Well, that actually, when I was in high school, I applied to go to England for a year, which I did. And when I was interviewed for that, I said to the interview committee, because Kennedy had just made his inaugural speech, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I said that, and I know they all clucked and looked at each other, and I felt that really impressed when I said that. But 4 years later, I don't know how much that really was part of my motivation to go and serve. I think my interest was much more to go and have a great time, have an adventure, to learn, rather than feeling that I was so great and I was from America, I was an American and I knew all about freedom and democracy and I was going to teach the world how they should live. And
that's interesting because Don Collins said that one of the reasons why he wanted to do this is because he felt naively, as he looks back, you know, he wanted to do something good for the not so much poor benighted peoples, but the less fortunate people of the world, that America could help them, and he realized, of course, actually quite rapidly, how mistaken he felt that position was. But you had more or less had your eyes open in the sense that you were more interested in other opportunities. You didn't believe you were going to save the world by idealistically joining.
Yeah.
Overseas,
you know, I had some experiences maybe through my life that I think helped me to put the U.S. in perspective. I grew up on the East Coast, and you know, the East Coast is very kind of Europe oriented, like the West Coast is Asia oriented, and I was 15, I think, for the first time. So I understood there were other places. I wasn't so centric on America. And after high school, I lived in England for a year. And when I was at Stanford, I lived in France for 9 months. And each of those experiences, the year in England and the near year in France, mm-hmm. were kind of peak experiences for me. I mean, I really loved them because I loved the experience of getting outside my own culture into another worldview, maybe another language, and seeing things as others see them. And so it put my own culture and country and experience in perspective. And so I think that I didn't have that absolutist feeling about my own culture that someone who may not have been overseas ever before might have more easily. So I don't think by that time in my life, I had this mission feeling about America.
Mm-hmm. And so you came back to the, you went to Greece, you came back to Vietnam, you were a full-fledged IBM volunteer.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, and did you report back to Don? Don was still your...
I guess so,
yeah. And what kind of work did, what kind of work did you assign?
Well, they sent me to Nha Trang for language training.
That's Nhatrang. We're not doing, we're being bad at this.
Oh, right.
You uh-huh. have to be doing that. And the place you were at was...
Before?
Yeah, it was Tuyethoa?
No, it was just Tuy.
Tuy.
Hoa. Tuy Hoa. In the province of Phu Yen, which was Phuyen.
Great.
So then I went up to Nhatrang for language training, and at some point, I don't know if it... So at some point, the decision was made that I was going to go to Dalat, D-A-L-A-T, which... I thought was really great, you know, because I was never too fond of Saigon. It was, you know, so hot and so noisy and so dirty. And Dalat, as you may know, is cool and is pleasant and is a lot like Berkeley, for instance.
It's a hill station, so.
Yeah, it's a hill station. Yeah, it was an R&R center for the French, and it had a very European feel about it. People living in villas, etc. So I thought that was actually pretty neat that I got to go to the lot. But, yeah, anyway, so I had this language training in Nha Trang, which was very pleasant. I mean, there were 6 or 8 of us, I think. And, we had 2 teachers, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. The one teacher spoke the central accent. Mm-hmm. The other teacher spoke a northern accent. Mm-hmm. So that was very confusing because the
accents... Well, it was deliberate, though, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't think so.
I mean, perhaps the idea was to give you a experience of all the dialects, so no matter where you were sent by, I guess, you'd at least understand that it was a different pronunciation.
You think IBS was that clever? That they
someone did in one of the oral histories. They said maybe that's what they were after. Oh. But I could see it would drive me totally insane.
I think they just found 2 teachers.
Yes, and, they found 2 teachers. So.
It ended up that way.
Do you remember who the folks were in your... I mean, do you remember any of the IBSers in that language class?
I can sort of see images of them. Oh, I know. One was Dave Nesmith. Mm-hmm.
Is it
Nesmith?
Nesmith.
N-E-S-M-I-T-H.
And is he the one who works for the Sierra Club?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Are you in contact with him at all?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that later, because I'd like to interview him.
If he's available. Yeah, that's right. He would be good to interview. Yeah. let's see. Another fellow, I can't remember his name. I think his name was John. Mm-hmm. And he went ultimately to... a province, or I think he went to Phu Yen province, but more remote than where I had been in Tuy Hoa. He went, and he actually left IBS in Vietnam after a while, and Don would know who he is, and I think Don has written about him maybe, because he almost went crazy
Yes.
With the contradictions, and he, the things he witnessed.
Would you say his first name was John?
I think so.
Okay. Because there are, those are, that, by the way, happened at the Peace Corps all the time.
Mm.
People went nuts, murdered people. Mm. It just wasn't, but, you know, you one would argue it was preconditioned, but when we talk about Vietnam, I mean, PTSD doesn't seem to have any predictors.
Uh-huh.
So it seems like more that the experience itself is very traumatic,
mm-hmm.
could be traumatic. So it'll be something worth looking at.
Yeah.
So I'll ask Don.
But I know he wrote letters, or he communicated somehow that there's kind of a record of
yes.
Of how
and I think
felt.
Don mentioned him too.
Yeah.
John.
Yeah. But he was blonde. I have pictures of him somewhere.
Great.
Yeah. But let me see, who else? But those are the people that come to mind.
And this is a 6 to 8 week program?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my teachers, the teacher with a central Vietnamese accent, her name was Nguyen Hoa,
mm-hmm.
Q-U-Y-N-H-H-O-A,
mm-hmm.
and she now lives in Washington, D.C.
No.
And Don would know her.
Okay.
She's a librarian. She went on to get her Ph.D. in library science.
Can you spell her first name?
Q-U-Y-N-H.
Y, there, got it, okay. Ask D.C. Because we'd like to talk to some people who are Vietnamese who work with IBS.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a language teacher. And those are the ones, basically.
Yeah.
Those are the language teachers that get in touch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the other one. But we, I don't know, yeah, China's a nice place. You know, there's a beach.
Mm-hmm.
And
my next question. What was so bad about Nha Trang? Well, it's a lot cooler in Da Lat, of course.
Oh,
but,
oh yeah. No, I don't think I would have minded staying in Nha Trang.
Uh-huh.
But there's an Oceanographic Institute, and we actually, I know on one day, because I still have pictures of it, we all went on a boat out sort of scuba diving. And I still have beautiful shells that I sent back to my mother for Christmas.
Are you still certified? Are you certified now as a scuba diver?
Oh, no.
No.
No, this was just
I am.
snorkeling, I guess.
Snorkeling.
You know.
See, I caught you in a lie. Okay, so nothing gets past us here.
Whatever.
Yes, or all history project.
Just those masks,
the
slippers.
Masks and
little
fins and stuff, yes. Yeah. And when you signed up for IBS, so you had a 2-year contract that would have begun in something like, When did that start? When did you assume your IBS duties?
Well, the fall of 66, so maybe September.
September? What did you say, September? Okay. And so you went to Nha Trang, you went through the language program.
Ah, yeah.
Yes, that's where we're at. Uh-huh.
Well, a couple of things. I, well, one. The experience of learning the language was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that, and it was the Vietnamese are very wonderful with foreigners who are making attempts to speak their language.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like living in a language laboratory, because we'd spend the morning studying language, and then you could go out into the laboratory and practice, and it was very reinforcing. And, you know, like going to market, I can remember going to market, and just the experience of knowing the sentence structure, like subject, verb, object, and we would practice substitutions. So I would know a verb, and the verbs don't conjugate, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's just go.
It's the best part.
Right. So you could say, I go market, or you go market, or she go market, or whatever. And so it's quite simple. So just going to market and you know, buying something was really fun, and it was very rewarding. So I felt like I was making great progress in the language, and I really loved it because it opened up that whole world of being able to talk to people and learn about their lives and, you know, hear about them and make friends, you know. So that was really neat. I really loved that.
And in the process, finding out whether they're married and how many children they
have. Yes. Or they're finding out about me.
Exactly right.
That's right.
And
So in the process of learning the language, one thing I recall is that I saw a newspaper, and in the newspaper I saw the word Asia Foundation, and I also saw the acronym CIA. Mm-hmm. So I bought the newspaper, and I guess with my teacher or somebody, I was able to translate or figure out what the article was about, which was that it had been revealed that the Asia Foundation was basically a front for the CIA. Mm-hmm. Asia Foundation. And I had a friend, a former roommate at Stanford, who at that time was working for the Asia Foundation. Mm-hmm. And his name was in the article too. Richard something like that. So I was really amazed. I was amazed at this revelation, for one, and that my friend was involved, for another. And it also had repercussions, because subsequently I was to work with youth in Dalat, including my wife. Mm-hmm. And their activities were funded by the Asia Foundation. Mm-hmm. And this sent, you know, shockwaves through the students that they were actually being funded by the CIA, you know, because they were very anti-American. I mean, they weren't pro-communist, but they were just very wary and suspicious of Americans. And so that knowledge at that time that their activities were being funded by the CIA through this conduit of this apparently neutral academic.
Well, what about Ong Jenkins? Is he working for the CIA?
Well, exactamente. Right. So that was always a threat to us. Uh-huh. And we had, you know, I think we had CIA people in IDS. Or actually, I don't really know that, but I know that former IDSers went on to work for the CIA.
Do you know the name of any IBSers who you know went on to work for the CIA?
Well, there's one guy, and okay. I have to work on his name.
Okay.
But
it's fairly important, because it was the issue isn't an idle one. But let's not get away from the. I don't want to get away.
You
from
must
this.
Have heard this from other people.
In the exact same way, which was.
Don't really know, but.
Don't really know. It was always rumored that somebody might use the IBS for CIA, you know, cover for IBS, but there isn't any, not only practical way that would be worked out, IBS would have to know about it.
Yeah.
Because of the payment. And it just seems extraordinarily unlikely. It is possible that someone who's in IBS, just like they would work for USAID after.
Got another job, right.
They could work for CIA, why not? But I did talk to people who work for CORS, and I asked them about IBS personnel, and they greatly admired IBS and tried to recruit them. IBS folk. It would be ridiculous for CORS to recruit CIA people out of IBS, if you see what I mean. In other words,
I mean, they liked having that conduit.
They liked having those people out there and trying to, co-opt them and use them within USAID. But, so why would the USAID want to recruit people already working for them? This is getting too tenuous. But the point is that no one has ever come up with any credible information, in fact, not even any kind of basis, in fact, that anybody in IBS was ever in IBS undercover from the CIA.
Right. So I would say that as well. But I would say that there were at least this one guy whose name I can't remember right now, but I think I will. Who subsequently worked for the CIA.
Well, if you can come up with his name, that'd be interesting, because it's verifiable. It doesn't mean that much. I mean, even if it was true, there was a CIA person undercover in IBS, that'd be something worth talking about. But it raises another issue, which is that, you know, you must have been shocked to find that the Asia Foundation was a cover for the for the CIA. Volunteers in Asia, did that make you think whether volunteers in Asia or IBS might also be a cover for the CIA?
Yeah.
And you came to the conclusion at the time that
that it wasn't.
Okay.
Although, I mean, the other aspect, though, one was always vigilant that one not be used for information gathering purposes. And I know when I was in Dalat, I was working with youth at the university. I was teaching English, so I was working with students. And I hung out with students a lot, and I knew them, you know, personally. I ended up marrying one, you know. Charlie Twining, recently retired U.S. ambassador to Cambodia, was with AID in Dalat at that time, 67. And he was in my sort of circle of friends. Although, again, I would always be careful not to get too close to the AID people, personally, because I didn't really like... AID was government. They were part of the war. IVS was also on contract to AID, which always made me very uncomfortable, because on the one hand, IVS posed as this international, you know, nonpartisan organization, but in Vietnam, it was on contract to AID. So basically, we were working for the U.S. government. And I did feel, while I was there, that we were being used, that we were, you know, the goody-goodies who we were doing good works and putting a good name on the U.S. presence. And I felt we were being used in that way. But in this particular instance, Charlie Twining, who I kind of kept at arm's length because he was an AID guy, but I knew him, came to my house with a guy who worked for the State Department. I'm making quotation marks around the word State Department because that was a euphemism for CIA, we felt. So he would be introduced as, this is Joe Blow, who's with the State Department. And at my front door, he said, he would like to talk to you about the students and your work with the students and what the students think and what they feel. And I said, well, I can't tell you about that. I won't talk to you. And Charlie Twining got angry. He said, oh, you know, don't be immature or something, you know, some silly thing. But I...
Spoken right to a 22-year-old. Right. Don't be immature. Well, I am still.
So, but I feel good about that because I held my ground and I didn't talk to them. But, you know, I don't know whether it was sort of before or after, but I became, I mean, since you asked, I became much more reluctant to submit reports to IVS. We were supposed to write monthly reports, and I did for a while, but I stopped after a while because I didn't really trust, I guess, IVS or the process. I didn't know where those reports were going. And I thought, what difference does it make? And why do they need to know? And I also have a streak in me that's kind of anti-authoritarian. Mm-hmm. I don't relate well to authority.
Where do you think that came from? Where do you think that came from, Chris? Yeah?
Oh, I don't know. I guess just my relationship to my father or something. I don't know.
What kind of relationship did you have?
To my reactionary.
Yes, exactly right. Do you think that other IVSers, I mean, in Dalat, there was an agricultural school outside of Dalat that IVS ran, and there were other IVSers in Dalat. Do you feel that efforts were made on a kind of ad hoc basis to pump IVSers for information generally?
I think, yes, efforts were made on an ad hoc basis to pump IVSers for information.
I'm glad you said that. Did you feel that there was anything systematic about that?
Not really, no, probably not. But we were always on the defensive, you know? I mean, I guess the goal of the organization, but definitely my goal was to get to know people and to be trusted by people. And if there's ever, I always felt like if there was ever a hint that we were part of the other American effort, the military or that civilian, you know, AID mission, that would really undercut people's credibility in who we were, that we were on their side, you know, and we didn't have a vested interest in the Americans winning the war or the American way of life being adored by Vietnamese. So I always felt defensive about that, and I would always go out of my way not to hang out with Americans, other Americans, IVSers, yes, mm-hmm. and other NGO kind of people. Those were my friends, but not the Americans. So in Dalat, it was fairly easy for me to do that because there weren't many Americans. You know, there weren't any military to speak of. Mm-hmm.
But there was Charles.
Charlie Twining mm-hmm. and the other AID people, but I didn't really relate to them much. Mm-hmm. Other IVSers in Dalat, I think, did a little bit more, mm-hmm. perhaps. You know, just drop by and socially hang out a bit.
Some had no choice because the only other people of European descent were MAG or, and then later MACV or...
In their posts or whatever,
there
yeah.
There was no one else.
But I think that also was because they maybe because of language or something, they weren't able to develop relations with Vietnamese that were enough, fulfilling enough for them.
That seems pretty standard. But the other thing was, though, you were in the English education. When you were in Dalat, you were
right. I was actually in community development.
You were in community development.
CD.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. You were in CD, but mm-hmm. What did you do in Dalat?
I taught English.
Yes, okay. That's the distinction seems to blur sometimes
right.
there.
Right.
And you taught at the university?
Or? Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you were teaching English as part of one of the options that students take as a foreign language?
Well, it was in the School of Politics, Economics, and Business Administration. And they just asked me to teach English, and I had no experience teaching English mm-hmm. ever before. And I didn't really take it very seriously. I didn't really like it too much. I thought it was sort of silly. And
why silly?
Well,
did you think being forced to take French at Stanford was silly? Maybe. no, I'm sorry. I take back that interjection. Very unprofessional of me. But the idea is that, why did you think it was silly teaching English at Dalat?
Well, I didn't take French at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Actually, I took it at high school.
No kidding.
That it was not very important. It was peripheral. It was... I feel differently about it now. I mean, I do think English is terribly important for people in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't think, it wasn't a real subject. It was peripheral. It wasn't history.
Well, I'll give
or
for an example,
philosophy
wouldn't a student who had some English experience be better able, for example, to do agriculture?
No.
Because he could read seed directions.
No.
No.
If anything, it would make them more able to be influenced by the whole American presence, you know. He's more easily seduced.
And why do you think it's good for Vietnamese to learn English now?
Oh, because they're an independent country. They beat us, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they need to compete and communicate in the world. And nobody speaks Vietnamese out there. You know, people speak English. That's the
well,
language.
Now that you've stepped right into the trap that I laid for you, why wouldn't the citizens of the Republic of Vietnam, who happen to be involved in a titanic Cold War struggle, not also benefit as individuals from being able to tap into a world?
Because their existence was conditional on control and domination by the Americans. I mean, they were a client, you know, colony of the U.S.
So you just stepped, you went right through the trap door and you fell all the way to the bottom. That's good, okay. These probing questions. Barbara Walters has nothing on me. But I mean, that was your impression, but your impression of that, what, I realize this is an older general question, but there's no simple way of putting it. What made you think that the society of South Vietnam was literally this kind of American construct for the Cold War? Other than, you know, the massive American presence, I mean, you were there,
yeah.
Actually you started there. You know, this is the biggest actual the biggest buildup really was from essentially 30,000 to 250,000, which is through the summer of 1965.
Wow. Yeah.
But after that, 66, 67, we have, it doubles, half a million troops in Vietnam then.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a physical presence.
Right.
But what at the time, what made you think that there was something unsavory about the government? That actually you were actually an employee, by the way, of the Vietnamese government. You were paid by USAID through IVS, which was contracting. You're being paid in Vietnamese money, even though the money came from USAID.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think very many people thought about that. Some people
no. So you just said that I was working for the Vietnamese government?
In essence, you were doing work contracted through IVS for the Vietnamese government, and USAID was paying for it.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, that isn't the gospel truth, because I haven't talked to Don about this specifically, but most people think IVS was contracted with USAID, and it was. But the way the contract worked was, IVS was supplying the Vietnamese government people to work under their various ministries.
Uh-huh.
And the USAID was paying for it.
Okay.
And so if you were doing education, or if you were working at the university, that money was being, that money was coming from the U.S. and into, let's say, the Department of Education of Vietnam. I'm not saying that this is the way it was.
Right.
It's just interesting that no one's looked at the follow-up of money. But what made you feel that the government... The point of the question was that you thought that Vietnam now needs to plug into the world market and a global economy.
Mm-hmm.
They need to speak English. Mm-hmm. But when you were in Vietnam then, you felt teaching these people English is just allowing them to become essentially more closely tied to the American war effort.
Mm-hmm.
That assumption means that the Republic of South Vietnam doesn't have any legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could recall then why you felt that way.
Yeah.
Why you felt that you were kind of working in a...
Well, you know what? If you will, that was the very question that was being posed, I guess, before I left. You know, I mean, those were the charges that were being made. So I was really primed for that impression. And I had set out to Vietnam to try to form my own impressions, or to find out what was the real answer. And so the question is, why did I end up feeling then, by this time, that the Republic of Vietnam really was a client state? Mm-hmm. You know, I had Wilfred Brichet's books, for instance, which were very popular among my Vietnamese friends. Mm-hmm. Inside North Vietnam, or that was...
Inside the Viet Cong, I think was.
Oh, okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
Not
inside of the account, but it was close to that.
Yeah. I think because I was already at that time kind of a relativist, I knew that there was another side to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you're denied knowing about the other side, you really want to learn about the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So already I was, you know, prepared to discount the truth of what the Republic of Vietnam was saying. I also have my personality, I guess, is to kind of favor the underdog, is to, and those two things kind of go hand in hand, you know, to sort of, but look at these poor people, you know, look what they've been through, and look what they're trying to do, and look at the level of their integrity, you know, compared to these people. And, you know, I had already had some experiences in Thuy Hoa, maybe, which I told you about, living with the judge and seeing their style of life and the contrasts with other people who weren't so fortunate. And so they were on the defensive, you know. And, you know, stories of, not my own personal experience, I guess, but stories of corruption and lack of integrity were widespread already before I went. So I think I was already kind of set up before I went. The students were telling, I mean, they fit in, easily. I mean, my experience at the University of DeLatte was very much an extension of my experience at Stanford University. In other words, the same issues were being discussed. it was just the other side of the world, you know. But it was a continuation. I mean, in many ways, that my experience was kind of like being an exchange student. I really felt like, rather than being an English teacher or someone on a pedestal, an authority, an administrator or something, I was just a student, another student, and I happened to speak English. So that's what my classes were like a lot. They were very much hanging out together. I didn't prepare lessons. I didn't know anything about all that stuff. I would just go and we would talk.
Well, what were the political views of the students like, considering that most of them were very privileged?
Right.
But were they privileged like the privileged in the United States then, who supposedly, according to,
a little bit, yeah. Like me.
Yes, exactly.
they were critical of the U.S. They were critical of their own government. They were cynical about their own government. They were very critical of the cultural imperialism that they viewed. They were proud of their own culture and their own background, and they took every opportunity to teach me about their long history and their nationalism and how they defeated the Chinese and they defeated the French and they defeated the Japanese, and they probably would defeat the... Well, they didn't say that, though. They didn't really actually go quite that far. So that's why I can say that they weren't pro-communist, you know. But they... Since they were so critical of the Americans and their own government, it kind of opened up an acceptance of the other side. You know, no one ever said, you know, the best people are the NLF. Mm-hmm. But they created a vacuum into which that idea would creep. And, you know, in those years, there was something called the Third Force. Mm-hmm. So that was the Buddhists and maybe progressive Catholics and people who were saying that there's a better way between these two ideologies that are fighting it out on our turf, which is a more Vietnamese way, perhaps, you know, and a pacifist way. And that was attractive. And I know that... I was given the book Lotus in a Sea of Fire
yeah.
by Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah.
And that was actually when I was still in Thuy Hoa. I was given that in English. And I read that. And that was a wonderful book. I just thought that was...
That was the first book one of the first books on the war that I ever got. I got it.
Is that right?
Used bookstore now in Westwood.
Uh-huh.